king, a bishop, and a pawn versus a king, queen, both rooks, knight, bishop, and six pawns. Is there some reason I shouldn't just tip my king over and quit?
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast, which you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this insightful message.
And again, good morning. Everyone has probably been involved at some point or another in a competitive game, choose your game, chess, basketball, tiddlywinks, whatever, but you were involved in a game where it reached a point where the question was no longer who was going to win and who was going to lose, because that much had already been determined before the game was over. The score is 113-5. Do we really need to play this last quarter? Or it's a king, a bishop, and a pawn versus a king, queen, both rooks, knight, bishop, and six pawns. Is there some reason I shouldn't just tip my king over and quit? Maybe. Maybe you play it out to learn a lesson. Or maybe you play it out to give your backbenchers a chance to gain some experience. Or maybe you're just an eternal optimist. I can still turn this around! Maybe you're just stubborn. Or maybe you quit, resign your king, concede the court, call it a night. With games like these, whatever you choose, we all get to go home with nothing worse than bruised egos and try again tomorrow. With things like war, it's a little different. When, for instance, the atomic bomb is a new kind of weapon and the only people who have it drop a couple on your major cities, you break out the white flag, because otherwise you will be annihilated. When it comes down to throwing rocks at tanks whose steel treads are about to roll over your capital city, you can play it out to the bitter end and go down throwing rocks. Or you can surrender and hope to make the best of being defeated. David wrote Psalm 60 from a moment about like this. This is the last psalm that we will undertake this year. It is also the first Christmas sermon. Maybe you did not hear a Christmas message in the reading of that psalm. Bear with me. I think I see one in there. God led David through a series of seemingly insurmountable obstacles and the prospect of hopeless defeat after hopeless defeat to get the man on the throne. David went through a lot of moments in that process where the sensible seeming thing would have been to give up. Of course, some of those times giving up meant dying right now, while fighting on meant living another 10 minutes anyway, and that kind of changes the dynamics of the game. But David learned in a hard school to trust God in the face of hopeless situations and insurmountable obstacles. And then he became king, and everything was peachy and rosy from then on, right? Not so much. But David had some ambitions as king. And he was able to fulfill some of them. He wanted to build the temple. That was not granted him. He was told that would have to wait for his son Solomon, who would be, God foretold, a king of peace. And I should note here, this is partly my fault in the notes that I write for the PowerPoint people. My handwriting is really atrocious. So that should be, David was a king of war. And it says work. But the computer's misbehaving this morning. For them to try to fix that right now will pretty much crash the system. So we're stuck with David was a king of work. But when you read that, you know that it should say David was a king of war. Very good. Just so we're all clear on that. Solomon would be a king of peace, partly because David was a king of war. Looked at one way, God's instructions to David to save the building of the temple for his heir can amount to nothing more complicated than, look, you got bigger fish to fry, pal. Once you have conquered and consolidated all this territory, then we'll talk about temple building. And David knew what the territory that had been promised to his ancestor Abraham was supposed to look like. Mount Hermon up on the north and Mount Sinai down on the south, and the Mediterranean coast over there on the west and the Euphrates River on the east. That's what it was supposed to look like, but it didn't look like that completely. Four lines on a map. Easy peasy mac and cheesy, right? Except there were these places here, there, and the other within those lines where foreign powers had long set up housekeeping, and they were kind of slow to just cede the territory and go home. Those Philistines over on the west coast wanted to stay right where they were, right where they had built cities and raised their families for generations. They wanted to stay there bad enough that if you suggested they shouldn't, they were ready to fight about it. And those Assyrians living up in the north in the breadbasket liked living in the most fertile region of the land promised to Abraham. They liked it a lot, and they didn't want to leave either. And I think that probably at some point it occurred to David, holy smokes, no wonder God wouldn't let me build the temple. It's all I can do to build enough barracks and armories and way stations and supply depots to sustain the Eastern Front. Fortunately for David, he wasn't having much trouble on the south at the time. But David was a king of war, trying to pull the land promised to Abraham back into a cohesive unit. Solomon would just marry the daughters of all his enemies. And that worked out better, huh? David's mission was rendered more difficult by the fact that David frequently slipped into sin. And he ruled over people who were prone to sin. And when the people of God cannot maintain their relationship with God, the mission given them by God suffers. So sometimes David's military efforts bogged down, and sometimes they worse than bogged down. And this was one of those moments here that he writes about in Psalm 60 where it looked like everything was pretty much lost. Now, the information is contained in the heading, so you can read that and go back to the books of Samuel and Chronicle and find out more about the specifics. But things are going badly at a critical juncture. And if David loses here, it will probably be that moment where the outcome, winners and losers, is no longer in question. If he loses here, he will lose everything. He will not only fail to break the pagan strongholds, he will lose the entire land promised to his ancestor Abraham and probably his life in the bargain. Maybe the best thing to do is just sound the retreat and scat straight back to Jerusalem and hole up while you still have an army to hole up with. Or maybe the best thing to do is wave the white flag and surrender and plead for clemency and promise to pay exorbitant tribute to your new masters. Or you could always fight it out to the bitter end, given the circumstances. The sentiments that we find early in the psalm are not surprising. Seems like you're pretty much done with us, God. You've grabbed our country and shaken it till it's about to fall to pieces. If life is a drink, then you have poured us a stiff one. The kind that makes you walk crooked. And yet, this is the point where David remembers what he learned in that hard school of impossible situations and seemingly inevitable defeat back in the days before he was king. God can turn impossible situations around. Amen. God can snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. Amen. God can do these things. There are breaches. God made the breaches. God can heal the breaches. There are difficult circumstances, trials and tribulations. God led us into these things. God can lead us out. We're broken. God broke us. God can restore us. We're striving over the land, David says. But the land belongs to God. Ephraim is God's. Gilead is God's too. And Moab and Edom most certainly belong to God. Even Philistia, David's greatest long-term enemy, even Philistia belongs to God. Shout, Philistia, shout it out loud. I belong to God. God can dispose the land as he pleases. Things are not out of God's control. Who will help me, David asks, against my adversaries? I'll tell you who will. God will. Who will bring me into the besieged city? That is to say, you know that place over here where I'm losing this fight and they got this big wall and it's filled with armaments and hostile soldiers? Who's going to get me past that wall and into this place so I can declare victory? Who will lead me into the besieged city? I'll tell you who will. God will. God, David says, puts a banner into the hands of those who fear and love him. And those who fear and love God have an obligation to hold that banner high so that everyone can see it, so that when the people of God emerge from the gathering darkness victorious, everybody knows who to credit. Deliverance by man is vain. But through God, we shall do valiantly. And it is he who will tread down our adversaries. Which is why David neither surrendered nor retreated when everything seemed impossible and victory was snatched from the jaws of defeat there in the Valley of Salt. And God's people were victorious. And David glorified God, for instance, in this psalm, which is originally titled Shushan Iduth, which means the lily of testimony, a testimony that, like a beautiful flower, opens to shed forth the glory of God. Well done, David. I really don't need to give you specifics to prove that the world is dark and distressing and threatening in our day. You already know it. We could talk about terrorism and bombings and shootings, which get ever closer to home. And we could talk about societal decay and rot and the failing infrastructure and the woes of the economy. We could talk about all those things. But you already know there are many things that look bad. There's something else that you know. You know it if you think of it. San Bernardino is God's. It belongs to God. The Middle East, that's God's too. And Europe and Africa. Asia belongs to God. Australia as well. And the polls, whichever reports you take into consideration about how much ice remains there, the polls are God's too, to do with as He pleases. Things look bad. But God puts a banner in the hands of those who fear and love Him, and it is the obligation of those who fear and love Him to hold that banner high in the midst of the gathering darkness, so that when the people of God emerge victorious, everyone will know who to credit. Hold His banner high, church. The darkness will not be relieved otherwise. And the peoples of the world need us to lift up the banner of Jesus Christ. They need it badly. Who will take me into the besieged city? Wherever it may be, and it may be that it's come to rest in Washington, D.C., the besieged city, but who will take me into the besieged city? God will. Let me wind down now by trying to impress upon you how sure that promise is, no matter how hopeless things appear. We could look further at David, of course. We could look at our own experience as Americans, and there are things to be learned there. But there was this other time, this one time, when everything looked really, really bad. The Roman Republic had risen, and admittedly through a series of intense, violent wars, taken over the known world. Everything that Alexander the Great ever held, plus, became the Roman Republic. And then there was this guy who, as a matter of picking up emergency powers in the midst of a crisis, isn't it amazing how those temporary emergency powers always become permanent? But this guy picked up temporary emergency powers for the crisis and became the first Roman Emperor. And his son, after a series of wars over the matter, followed in his father's footsteps and became the second Roman emperor. And he demanded to be worshipped as a god. And he changed his name from Octavius to the one you're more familiar with, Augustus. One who deserves to be worshipped, that name means. The rule of the emperors became increasingly cruel, petty, and abusive. People subject to the Romans suffered one insult and deprivation after another. Confiscatory taxes spread poverty among the territories while Rome grew ever more opulent. A Roman soldier pointed a sword at you and barked an order, and you obeyed. If it meant giving up a day's work to carry that guy's pack, you did it. Even if it involved your beautiful unmarried daughter, you obeyed or you died. And it wasn't safe to speak up against the emperor if you wanted to go on living. And the few who tried to lead military revolts ended up writhing on crosses every so many yards along the major thoroughfares to discourage others from making similar attempts. It was bad. And the people of God, the children of Abraham, the descendants of David, they were caught right in the middle of it, slaves to the emperor like everybody else. And the Jewish king, their king, had long ago sold out to Rome, doing whatever Rome wanted to be able to stay in power, so he was no help to his people. And the Jewish priest, their own religious institution, had done the same thing, sold out to Rome to maintain their power and wealth, so that the religious institution was, by and large, not very much help to a captive, dominated people. One of the few ways the average person might hope to become rich was to become a hated tax collector, rounding up those brutally punitive taxes from his own people in his own neighborhood, keeping a nice cut for himself before forwarding the balance on to Rome. It was bad. And it was rapidly getting worse. It seemed to have passed the point where there could be any rational hope for victory or deliverance. Perhaps the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, but he seems to have safely deposited the whole into the hands of Caesar Augustus. What are we going to do about that? Who will heal the breaches? Who will restore us? Who will lead us into the besieged city? Interesting question, that last. Who will lead us even into Rome, the heart of all the evil and trouble? Because the truth is, when they looked around, there didn't seem to be any promising candidates. And into the midst of this very dark and troubled time, God sent His Son, Jesus Christ, deity, clothed in human flesh. And He held up high the banner of God and was killed, of course. I mean, you can't just draw the ire of Rome or even of the local establishments who play ball with Rome to keep peace and prosperity. You can't draw their ire without consequences. So He was killed. And to a lot of people, it seemed like the very last glimmer of hope died with Him. Seemed that way for about 3 days. And then Jesus rose from the dead and set in motion the events that would lead to the gospel conquering Rome. Who will lead us into the besieged city? I tell you who will. God. Who will lead us into the besieged city? You need to say it like you mean it. Who will lead us into the besieged city? And the besieged city may locate itself where and whensoever. And the darkness may deepen toward absolute. And yet Jesus Christ will lead us there, and the people of God will know victory along with the Son of God. Beginning with the Psalm of David, I come to this. Merry Christmas. Understand what has been done for us.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church with a quick visit to our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.